CD 8.
Beverly Hills, Saturday, October 9th, 1:13 p.m. As Evans climbed the steps to his apartment, he could hear the television blaring. It seemed louder than before. He heard cheers and laughter, some sort of show with a live studio audience. He opened the door and went into the living room. The private investigator from the courtyard was sitting on the couch, his back to Evans while he watched television. His jacket was off and flung over a nearby chair. He had his arm draped across the back of the sofa. His fingers drummed impatiently. "I see you made yourself at home," Evans said. "Pretty loud, don't you think? Would you mind turning it down?" The man didn't answer. He just continued to stare at the TV. "Did you hear me?" Evans said. "Turn it down, would you?" The man did not move, just his fingers moving restlessly on the back of the couch. Evans walked around to face the man. "I'm sorry, I don't know your name, but..." He broke off. The investigator hadn't turned to look at him, but continued to stare fixedly at the TV. In fact, no part of his body moved. He was immobile, rigid. His eyes didn't move. They didn't even blink. The only part of his body that moved was his fingers on the top of the couch. They almost seemed to be twitching, in spasm. Evans stepped directly in front of the man. "Are you all right?" The man's face was expressionless. His eyes stared forward, seeming to look straight through Evans. "Sir?" The investigator was breathing shallowly, his chest hardly moving. His skin was tinged with gray. "Can you move at all? What happened to you?" "Nothing." The man was rigid. "Just like the way they described Margot," Evans thought. "The same rigidity, the same blankness." Evans picked up the phone and dialed 911, called for an ambulance to his address. "Okay, help is coming," he said to the man. The private detective gave no visible response, but even so, Evans had the impression that the man could hear, that he was fully aware inside his frozen body. But there was no way to be sure. Evans looked around the room, hoping to find clues as to what had happened to this man. But the apartment seemed undisturbed. One chair in the corner seemed to have been moved. The guy's smelly cigar was on the floor in the corner as if it had rolled there. It had burned the edge of the rug slightly. Evans picked up the cigar. He brought it back to the kitchen, ran it under the faucet, and tossed it in the wastebasket. Then he had an idea. He went back to the man. "You were going to bring me something." There was no movement, just the fingers on the couch. "Is it here?" The fingers stopped, or almost stopped. They still moved slightly, but there was clearly an effort being made. "Can you control your fingers?" Evans said. They started, then stopped again. "So you can, okay. Now, is the thing you wanted me to see here?" The fingers moved, then stopped. "I take that as a yes, okay?" Evans stepped back. In the distance, he heard an approaching siren. The ambulance would be here in a few minutes, he said. "I'm going to move in one direction, and if it is the right direction, move your fingers." The fingers started, then stopped, as if to signal yes. "Okay," Evans said. He turned and took several steps to his right, heading toward the kitchen. He looked back. The fingers did not move. "So it's not that way." He now moved toward the television, directly in front of the man. The fingers did not move. "All right, then." Evans turned left, walking toward the picture windows. Still, the fingers did not move. There was only one direction remaining. He moved behind the investigator, heading toward the door. Since the man could not see him, Evans said, "Now I am walking away from you, toward the front door." The fingers did not move. "Maybe you didn't understand," Evans said. "I wanted you to move your fingers if I was heading in the right direction." Fingers moved, scratching the couch. "Yeah, okay, but which direction? I went in all four directions and..." The doorbell rang. Evans opened it, and two paramedics rushed in, bringing a stretcher. And now there was pandemonium. They were asking him rapid-fire questions and loading the guy onto the stretcher. The police arrived a few minutes later with still more questions. They were the Beverly Hills police, so they were polite, but they were insistent. This man was paralyzed in Evans's apartment, and Evans did not seem to know anything about it. Finally, a detective came through the door. He wore a brown suit and introduced himself as Ron Perry. He gave Evans his card. Evans gave him his own card. Perry looked at it, then looked at Evans and said, "Haven't I seen this card before? It looks familiar." "Oh yeah, I remember. It was at that apartment on Wilshire where the lady was paralyzed. She was my client. And now it's happened again. The same paralysis," Perry said. "Is that a coincidence or what?" "I don't know," Evans said, "because I wasn't here. I don't know what happened."
"Somehow people just become paralyzed wherever you go."
"No," Evans said, "I told you, I don't know what happened."
"Is this guy a client too?"
"No."
"Then who is he?"
"I have no idea who he is."
"No? How'd he get in here?"
Evans was about to say he had left the door open for him, but he realized that was going to be a long explanation, and a difficult one. Sometimes I don't lock my door."
"You should always lock your door, Mr. Evans. That's just common sense."
"Of course you're right."
"Doesn't your door lock automatically when you leave?"
"I told you I don't know how he got in my apartment," Evans said, looking directly into the detective's eyes. The detective returned the stare.
"How'd you get those stitches in your head?"
"I fell."
"Looks like quite a fall."
"It was." The detective nodded slowly.
"You could save us a lot of trouble if you'd just tell me who this guy is, Mr. Evans. You got a man in your apartment. You don't know who he is. You don't know how he got here. Forgive me if I feel you're maybe leaving something out."
"I am."
"Okay." Perry took out his notebook. "Go ahead."
"The guy's a private detective."
"I know that."
"You do?" Evans said.
"The paramedics checked his pockets, found a license in his wallet. Go on."
"He told me he'd been hired by a client of mine."
"Uh-huh. Which client is that?"
Perry was writing. "I can't tell you that," Evans said. He looked up from his pad.
"Mr. Evans,
I'm sorry, that's privileged." The detective gave a long sigh.
"Okay, so this guy is a private investigator hired by a client of yours."
"Right," Evans said. "The investigator contacted me and said he wanted to see me, to give me something."
"To give you something?"
"Right."
"He didn't want to give it to the client."
"He couldn't."
"Because?"
"The client is, unavailable."
"I see. So he came to you instead."
"Yes. And he was a bit paranoid and wanted to meet me in my apartment."
"So you left the door to your apartment open for him?"
"Yes."
"Some guy you'd never seen before?"
"Yes, well, I knew he was working for my client."
"How'd you know that?"
Evans shook his head. "Privileged."
"Okay, so this guy comes into your apartment. Where are you?"
"I was at my office." Evans quickly recounted his movements during the intervening 2 hours.
"People saw you at the office?"
"Yes."
"Conversations?"
"Yes."
"More than one person?"
"Yes."
"You see anybody else besides people in the law firm?"
"I stopped to get gas."
"Attendant will recognize you."
"Yes. I had to go in to use my credit card."
"Which station?"
"Shell on Pico."
"Okay.
So, you were gone 2 hours. You come back here and the guy is, as you saw him, paralyzed." "And what was he going to give you?"
"I have no idea." You didn't find anything in the apartment?
No.
Anything else you want to tell me?
No.
Another long sigh.
Look, Mr. Evans, if two people I knew were mysteriously paralyzed, I'd be a little worried. But you don't seem worried.
Believe me, I'm worried, Evans said. The detective frowned at him.
Okay,
he said finally. You have a client privilege you're invoking. I have to tell you that I've gotten calls from UCLA and from the CDC on this paralysis thing. Now that there's a second case, there are going to be more calls.
He flipped his notebook shut. I'm going to need you to come by the station and give us a signed statement. Can you do that later today?
I think so.
4 o'clock?
Yes, fine.
The address is on the card. Just ask for me at the desk. Parking is under the building.
Okay,
Evans said. See you then,
the detective said, and turned to leave. Evans shut the door behind him and leaned against it. He was glad to finally be alone. He walked around the apartment slowly, trying to focus his thoughts. The television was still on, but the sound was turned off. He looked at the couch where the private investigator had been sitting. The indentation of his body was still visible. He still had half an hour before he was supposed to meet with Drake, but he wanted to know what the PI had brought to him. Where was it? Evans had moved in every direction of the compass, and each time the man had indicated with his fingertips that it was the wrong direction. Which meant what? He hadn't brought the thing? It was somewhere else? Or that whoever paralyzed him had taken it, so it was no longer there? Evans sighed. The critical question, is it here, was one he hadn't asked the detective. Evans just assumed it was there. And suppose it was. Where would it be? North, south, east, west? All wrong. Which meant... what? He shook his head. He was having trouble concentrating. The truth was the private investigator's paralysis had unnerved him more than he wanted to admit. He looked at the couch and the indentation. The guy couldn't move. It must have been terrifying. And the paramedics had lifted him up bodily like a sack of potatoes and put him on the stretcher. The cushions on the couch were in disarray, a reminder of their efforts. Idly, Evan straightened up the couch, putting the cushions in place, fluffing them. He felt something, inside a slit in one cushion. He stuck his hand deeper into the padding. Damn! Of course, it was obvious in retrospect. Moving away in every direction was wrong, but the investigator wanted Evans to move toward him. The guy was sitting on the thing, which he had slipped inside the couch cushion. It turned out to be a shiny DVD. Evans dropped it in the DVD player and watched as a menu came up, a list of dates. They were all in the last few weeks. Evans clicked on the first date. He saw a view of the NERF conference room. It was a side angle from the corner of the room, waist high. It must have been from a camera hidden in the speaker's podium or something, Evans thought. Undoubtedly, the investigator had installed the camera the day Evans had seen him in the NERF conference room. At the bottom of the screen was a running time code, numbers flickering. But Evans stared at the image itself, which showed Nicholas Drake talking to John Henley, the PR guy. Drake was upset, throwing up his hands. "I hate global warming," Drake said, almost shouting. "I fucking hate it! It's a goddamn disaster!"
"It's been established," Henley said calmly, "over many years. It's what we have to work with."
"To work with? But it doesn't work," Drake said. "That's my point. You can't raise a dime with it, especially in winter. Every time it snows, people forget all about global warming, or else they decide that some warming might be a good thing after all. They're trudging through the snow, hoping for a little global warming. It's not like pollution, John. Pollution worked. It still works. Pollution scares the shit out of people. You tell them they'll get cancer, and the money rolls in. But nobody is scared of a little warming, especially if it won't happen for 100 years.
You have ways to play it, Henley said.
Not anymore, Drake said. We've tried them all. Species extinction from global warming. Nobody gives a shit. They've heard that most of the species that will become extinct are insects. You can't raise money on insect extinctions, John. Exotic diseases from global warming. Nobody cares. Hasn't happened. We ran that huge campaign last year connecting global warming to the Ebola and hantaviruses. Nobody went for it. Sea level rise from global warming. We all know where that'll end up. The Vanuatu lawsuit is a fucking disaster. Everybody will assume the sea level isn't rising anywhere. And that Scandinavian guy, that sea level expert, he's becoming a pest. He's even attacking the IPCC for incompetence.
Yes, Henley said patiently. That's all true.
So you tell me, Drake said. How the hell am I supposed to play global warming? Because you know what I have to raise to keep this organization going, John. I need $42 million a year. The foundations will only give me a quarter of that this year. The celebrities show up at the fundraisers, but they don't give a shit. They're so egotistical, they think showing up should be payment enough. Of course, we sue the EPA every year, and they may cough up $3-4 million. With EPA grants, maybe 5 total. That still leaves a big gap, John. Global warming isn't going to cut it. I need a fucking cause, a cause that works.
I understand, Henley said, still very calm. But you are forgetting the conference.
Oh, Christ, the conference, Drake said. These assholes can't even get the posters right. Bendix is our best speaker. He's got a family problem. Wife is having chemo. Gordon was scheduled, but he's got some lawsuit about his research. Seems his notebooks were faked.
Those are details, Nicholas, Henley said. I'm asking you to stay with the big picture. At that moment, the phone rang. Drake answered it, listened briefly. Then he put his hand over the phone and turned to Henley.
We have to continue this later, John. I've got an emergency here.
Henley got up and left the room. The clip ended. The screen went black. Evan stared at the blank screen. He felt as if he were going to be ill. A wave of dizziness passed over him. His stomach churned. He held the remote in his hand, but he did not press the buttons. The moment passed. He took a breath. On reflection, he realized that what he had seen wasn't really surprising. Perhaps Drake was more explicit in private. Everyone was. And obviously he felt under pressure to raise money. But the frustration he expressed was perfectly understandable. From the beginning, the movement had had to fight apathy in the broader society. Human beings didn't think in the long term. They didn't see the slow degradation of the environment. It had always been an uphill battle to rouse the public to do what was really in its own best interest. That fight was far from over. In fact, it was just beginning. And it was probably true that it wasn't easy to raise money for global warming. So Nicholas Drake had his work cut out for him. And environmental organizations were really working with very small funds. $44 million for NERF. The same for the NRDC, maybe 50 for the Sierra Club. The big one was the Nature Conservancy. They had $750 million. But what was that compared with the zillions of dollars that could be mobilized by corporations? It was David and Goliath. And Drake was David, as he had said himself on every occasion. Evans glanced at his watch. In any case, it was time to go see Drake. He took the DVD out of the player, slipped it into his pocket, and left the apartment. On his way, he reviewed what he was going to say. He went over it again and again, trying to make it perfect. He had to do it carefully, because everything Kenner had told him to say was a lie. Beverly Hills, Saturday, October 9th, 11:12 a.m.
Peter, Peter!
Nicholas Drake said, shaking his hand warmly.
I am very pleased to see you. You've been away.
Yes.
But you haven't forgotten my request.
No, Nick.
Have a seat.
Evan sat down and Drake sat behind the desk.
Go ahead.
I traced the origin of that clause.
Yes?
Yes, you were right. George did get the idea from a lawyer.
I knew it. Who?
An outside attorney, not in our firm. Evan spoke carefully, saying just what Kenner had instructed him to say.
Who?
Unfortunately, Nick, there's documentation. Red-line drafts with George's handwritten comments.
Ah, shit. From when?
6 months ago.
6 months?
Apparently, George has been concerned for some time about things.
The groups he supports.
He never told me.
Nor me, Evan said.
He chose an outside attorney. I want to see this correspondence,
Drake said. Evan shook his head.
The attorney will never permit it.
George is dead.
Privilege continues after death. Swidler and Berlin versus United States.
This is bullshit, Peter. And you know it.
Evan shrugged.
But this attorney plays by the book, and I have arguably overstepped proper bounds by saying as much as I have.
Drake drummed his fingers on the desktop.
Peter, the Venutu lawsuit is desperately in need of that money.
I keep hearing, Evan said, that lawsuit may be dropped.
Nonsense.
Because the data sets don't show any rise in Pacific sea level.
I'd be careful about saying things like that,
Drake said.
Where did you hear that? Because that has to be disinformation from industry, Peter. There is no question sea levels are rising around the world. It's been scientifically demonstrated time and again.
Why, just the other day I was looking at the satellite measurements of sea level, which are a relatively new way to make those measurements. The satellites show a rise of several millimeters just in the last year.
Was that published data?
Evan said.
I don't remember offhand.
Drake said, giving him an odd look.
It was in one of the briefing summaries I get.
Evans hadn't planned to ask questions like these. They had just somehow come out of his mouth, unbidden, and he was uncomfortably aware that his tone was skeptical. No wonder Drake was giving him an odd look.
I don't mean anything, Evan said quickly. It's just that I heard these rumors.
And you wanted to get to the bottom of it,
Drake said, nodding,
as is only natural.
I'm glad you brought this to my attention, Peter. I'll get on the horn with Henley and find out what's being disseminated.
Of course, it's an endless battle.
You know, we have those Neanderthals at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and the Hoover Foundation, and the Marshall Institute to deal with. Groups financed by right-wing radicals and brain-dead fundamentalists.
But unfortunately, they have a tremendous amount of money at their disposal. Yes, I understand, Evan said. He turned to go. Do you need me for anything else?
I'll be frank, Drake said. I'm not happy. Are we back to $50,000 a week?
Under the circumstances, I think we have no option.
Then we will have to manage, Drake said. The lawsuit's going fine, by the way. But I have to focus my energies on the conference.
Oh, right.
When does that start?
Wednesday,
Drake said. 4 days from now. Now, if you'll excuse me...
Of course, Evan said. He walked out of the office, leaving his cell phone on the side table across from the desk.
Evans had gone all the way down the stairs to the ground floor before he realized Drake hadn't asked him about his stitches. Everyone else he had seen that day had made some comment about them, but not Drake. Of course, Drake had a lot on his mind with the preparations for the conference. Directly ahead,
Evans saw the ground floor conference room bustling with activity. The banner on the wall read, "Abrupt climate change, the catastrophe ahead." 20 young people clustered around a large table, on which stood a scale model of the interior of an auditorium and the surrounding parking lot. Evans paused to watch for a moment. One of the young people was putting wooden blocks in the parking lot to simulate cars.
"He won't like that," another one said. "He wants the slots nearer the building reserved for news vans, not buses."
"I left 3 spaces over here for news," the first kid said. "Isn't that enough?"
"He wants 10.
10 spaces? How many news crews does he think are going to show up for this thing?"
"I don't know, but he wants 10 spaces, and he's told us to arrange extra power and phone lines."
"For an academic conference on abrupt climate change?"
"I don't get it."
"How much can you say about hurricanes and droughts?"
"He'll be lucky to have 3 crews."
"Hey, he's the boss. Mark off the 10 slots and be done with it."
"That means the buses have to go way in the back."
10 slots, Jake."
"Okay, okay.
Next to the building, because the line feeds are very expensive. The auditorium's charging us an arm and a leg for the extra utilities."
At the other end of the table, a girl was saying, "How dark will it be in the exhibition spaces? Will it be dark enough to project video?"
"No, they're limited to flat panels."
"Some of the exhibitors have all-in-one projectors."
"Oh, that should be all right."
A young woman came up to Evans as he was standing looking into the room.
"Can I help you, sir?"
She looked like a receptionist. She had that bland prettiness.
"Yes," he said, nodding toward the conference room. "I was wondering how I arranged to attend this conference."
"It's by invitation only, I'm afraid," she said. "It's an academic conference, not really open to the public."
"I've just left Nick Drake's office," Evans said, "and I forgot to ask."
"Oh, well, actually, I have some comp tickets at the reception desk. Do you know which day you'll be attending?"
"All of them," Evans said.
"That's quite a commitment," she said, smiling. "If you'll come this way, sir."
It was only a short drive from NERF to the conference headquarters in downtown Santa Monica. Workmen on a cherry picker were placing letters on the large sign. So far it read, "Abrupt climate change," and beneath, "The catastrophe." His car was hot in the midday sun. Evans called Sarah on the car phone.
"It's done. I left my phone in his office."
"Okay. I was hoping you'd call earlier. I don't think that matters anymore."
"No, why?"
"I think Kenner already found out what he needed."
"He did?
Here, talk to him."
Evans thought, "She's with him?"
"Kenner speaking."
"It's Peter," he said.
"Where are you?"
"In Santa Monica. Go back to your apartment and pack some hiking clothes. Then wait there."
"For what?"
"Change all the clothes you are wearing now. Take nothing with you that you are wearing right now."
"Why?"
"Later."
Click.
The phone was dead. Back in his apartment, he hastily packed a bag. Then he went back to the living room. While he waited, he put the DVD back into the player and waited for the menu of dates. He chose the second date on the list. On the screen, he once again saw Drake and Henley. It must have been the same day because they were dressed in the same clothes. But now it was later. Drake had his jacket off, hung over a chair.
"I've listened to you before," Drake was saying.
He sounded resentful.
"And your advice didn't work."
"Think structurally," Henley said, leaning back in his chair, staring up at the ceiling, fingertips tented.
"What the hell does that mean?"
Drake said. "Think structurally, Nicholas, in terms of how information functions. What it holds up, what holds it up."
"This is just PR bullshit, Nicholas,"
Henley said sharply.
"I am trying to help you."
"Sorry." Drake looked chastened. He hung his head a little. Watching the video, Evans thought, "Is Henley in charge here?" For a moment, it certainly appeared that way.
Now then, Henley said, let me explain how you are going to solve your problem. The solution is simple. You have already told me. There was a loud pounding on Evans's door. Evans stopped the DVD and, just to be safe, removed it from the player and slipped it into his pocket. The pounding continued, impatient, as he went to the door. It was Sanyong Tapa. He looked grim. We have to leave, he said, right now. Part 5. Snake. Diablo, Sunday, October 10th, 2:43 p.m. The helicopter thumped over the Arizona desert, 20 miles east of Flagstaff, not far from Canyon Diablo. In the back seat, Sanyong handed Evans pictures and computer printouts. Speaking of the Environmental Liberation Front, he said, we assume their networks are up, but so are ours. All our networks are running, he said, and we picked up an unexpected clue from one of them. Of all things, the Southwestern Parks Management Association, which is, it is an organization of state park managers from all the western states, and they discovered that something very odd had happened. A large percentage of the state parks in Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico were booked in advance and paid for to reserve them for company picnics, school celebrations, institutional birthday parties, and so on, for this weekend. In each case, they were family affairs involving parents and kids, sometimes grandparents, too. True, this was a long 3-day weekend, but nearly all the advance bookings were for Monday. Only a handful had been for Saturday or Sunday. None of the park superintendents could remember such a thing happening before. I don't get it, Evans said. They didn't either, Sanyong said. They thought it might be some cult thing, and because the parks can't be used for religious purposes, they got on the phone and called some of the organizations. And they found in every case that the organization had received a special donation to fund the function on this particular weekend. Donation from whom? Charitable organizations. In every case, the situation was the same. They'd receive a letter saying, thank you for your recent request for funding. We are pleased to say we can support your get-together at such-and-such park on Monday, October 11th. The check has already been sent in your name. Enjoy your gathering. But the groups never requested the booking? No. So they'd call the charity, and someone would tell them it must have been a mix-up. But since the checks were already sent out, they might as well go ahead and use the park that day. And a lot of the groups decided they would. And these charitable organizations were none you ever heard of. The Amy Rossiter Fund? The Fund for a New America? The Roger V. and Eleanor T. Malkin Foundation? The Joyner Memorial Foundation? Altogether about a dozen charities. Real charities? Sanyong shrugged. We assume not, but we're checking that now. Evans said, I still don't get it. Somebody wants those parks used this weekend. Yes, but why? Sanyong handed him a photograph. It was an aerial shot in false colors, and it showed a forest, the trees bright red against a dark blue ground. Sanyong tapped the center of the picture. There, in the clearing in the forest, Evans saw what looked like a spider web on the ground, a series of concentric lines connecting fixed points, like a spider web. And that is, it's a rocket array. The launchers are the fixed points. The lines are the power cables to control the launch. His finger moved across the picture. And you see, there's another array here, and a third one here. The three arrays form a triangle, approximately 5 miles on each side. Evans could see it. Three separate spider webs set in clearings in the forest. Three rocket arrays? Yes. We know they have purchased 500 solid-state rockets. The rockets themselves are quite small. Close analysis of the picture elements indicates that the launchers are 4 to 6 inches in diameter,
which means the rockets are capable of going up about 1,000 feet or so. Not more than that. Each array is about 50 rockets, wired together. Probably not set to fire at the same time. And you notice the launchers are placed quite far apart.
But for what purpose? Evans said. These things are out in the middle of nowhere. They shoot up 1,000 feet and then fall back down. Is that it?
What's the point of that?
We don't know,
San Yong said.
But we have another clue. The picture you're holding in your hands was taken yesterday.
But here is a picture from a flyby this morning.
He handed Evans a second picture, showing the same terrain. The spiderwebs were gone.
What happened? Evans said.
They packed up and left.
You see, in the first picture, there are vans parked at the edge of the clearings. Apparently, they just put everything in the vans and
moved. Because they were spotted? It's unlikely they know they were spotted.
Then what?
We think they had to move to a more favorable setting.
More favorable for what? Evans said. What's going on?
It may be significant, San Yong said,
that at the time they purchased the rockets, they also purchased 150 kilometers of microfilament wire.
He nodded to Evans, as if that was supposed to explain everything.
150 kilometers?
San Yong flicked his eyes toward the helicopter pilot and shook his head.
We can go into it in greater detail later on, Peter.
And then he looked out the window.
Evan stared out the opposite window. He saw mile after mile of eroded desert landscape, cliffs brown with streaks of orange and red.
The helicopter rumbled northward.
He could see the helicopter's shadow racing over the sand, distorted, twisted, then recognizable again.
Rockets, he thought. San Yong had given him this information as if he were supposed to figure it out on his own.
500 rockets? Groups of 50 launchers set widely apart? 150 kilometers of microfilament wire?
Perhaps that was supposed to mean something, but Peter Evans didn't have the faintest idea what it could possibly be.
Groups of small rockets?
For what?
Microfilament for what? In his head, it was easy enough to calculate that if this microfilament was attached to the rockets, each rocket would have about 1/3 of a kilometer of wire. And 1/3 of a kilometer was roughly 1,000 feet.
Which was how high San Yong said the rockets could go anyway.
So these rockets were flying 1,000 feet into the air, dragging a microfilament wire behind them. What was the point of that? Or was the wire intended to be used to retrieve them later on? But no, he thought, that couldn't be. The rockets would fall back into the forest, and any microfilament would snap. And why were the rockets spaced widely apart? If they were only a few inches in diameter, couldn't they be packed closer together? He seemed to recall that the military had rocket launchers where the rockets were so close together the fins almost touched. So why should these rockets be far apart?
A rocket flies up, dragging a thin wire, and it gets to 1,000 feet and...
And what?
Perhaps, he thought, there was some instrumentation in the nose of each rocket. The wire was a way to transmit information back to the ground.
But what instrumentation?
What was the point of all this?
He glanced back to San Yong, who was now hunched over another photograph. What are you doing?
Trying to figure out where they've gone.
Evans frowned as he saw the picture in San Yong's hand. It was a satellite weather map. San Yong was holding a weather map.
Did all this have to do with weather?
Flagstaff, Sunday, October 10th, 8:31 p.m.
Yes,
Kenner said, leaning forward in the booth of the restaurant. They were in the back of a steakhouse in Flagstaff. The jukebox at the bar was playing old Elvis Presley, Don't be cruel. Kenner and Sarah had showed up just a few minutes before. Sarah, Evans thought, looked drawn and worried, not her usual cheerful self.
We think this is all about the weather, Kenner was saying. In fact, we're sure it is.
He paused while a waitress brought salads, then continued.
There are two reasons to think so. First, Alf has bought a considerable amount of expensive technology that seems to have no use in common, except perhaps attempts to influence the weather. And second, the...
Hold on, hold on, Evans said.
You said attempts to influence the weather?
Exactly.
Influence how?
Control it, San Yang said. Evans leaned back in the booth.
This is crazy, he said. I mean, you're telling me these guys think they can control the weather?
They can, Sarah said.
But how?
Evans said.
How could they do it?
Most of the research is classified.
Then how do they get it?
Good question, Kenner said. And we'd like to know that answer. But the point is, we assume that these rocket arrays are designed to produce major storms, or to amplify the power of existing storms.
By doing what?
They cause a change in the electric potentials of the infracumulus strata.
I'm glad I asked, Evans said. That's very clear.
We don't really know the details, Kenner said, although I'm sure we'll find out soon enough.
The strongest evidence, San Yang says, comes from the pattern of park rentals. These guys have arranged for lots of picnics over a large area, three states in point of fact, which means they are probably going to decide at the last minute where to act, based on existing weather conditions.
Decide what? Evans said.
What are they going to do?
Nobody spoke. Evans looked from one to another.
Well?
We know one thing, Kenner said. They want it documented. Because if there's one thing you can count on at a school picnic or a company outing with families and kids, it's lots of cameras. Lots of video, lots of stills.
And then, of course, the news crews will come, San Yang said.
They will? Why?
Blood draws cameras, Kenner said.
You mean they're going to hurt people?
I think it's clear, Kenner said, that they're going to try.
An hour later, they all sat on lumpy motel beds while San Yang hooked a portable DVD player to the television set in the room. They were in a crappy motel room in Shoshone, Arizona, 20 miles north of Flagstaff. On the screen, Evans once again saw Henley talking to Drake.
I've listened to you before, Drake said resentfully. And it didn't work.
Think structurally, Henley answered. He was leaning back in his chair, staring up at the ceiling, fingertips tented.
What the hell does that mean? Drake said.
Think structurally, Nicholas, in terms of how information functions. What it holds up, what holds it up.
This is just PR bullshit. Nicholas!
Henley said sharply, I am trying to help you.
Sorry.
Drake looked chastened. He hung his head a little. Watching the screen, Evans said,
Does it look like Henley is in charge here?
He's always been in charge, Kenner said. Didn't you know that? On the screen, Henley was saying, Let me explain how you are going to solve your problem, Nicholas. The solution is simple. You have already told me that global warming is unsatisfactory because whenever there is a cold snap, people forget about it.
Yes, I told.
So what you need, Henley said, is to structure the information so that whatever kind of weather occurs, it always confirms your message. That's the virtue of shifting the focus to abrupt climate change. It enables you to use everything that happens. There will always be floods and freezing storms and cyclones and hurricanes. These events will always get headlines and airtime. And in every instance, you can claim it was an example of abrupt climate change caused by global warming. so the message gets reinforced. The urgency is increased.
I don't know, Drake said doubtfully. That's been tried the last couple of years.
Yes, on a scattered individual basis. Isolated politicians making claims about isolated storms or floods. Clinton did it. Gore did it. That blithering science minister in England did it.
But we're not talking about isolated politicians, Nicholas. We're talking about an organized campaign throughout the world to make people understand that global warming is responsible for abrupt and extreme weather events.
Drake was shaking his head.
You know, he said, how many studies show no increase in extreme weather events?
Please!
Henley snorted. Disinformation from skeptics.
It's hard to sell. There are too many studies.
What are you talking about, Nicholas?
It's a snap to sell.
The public already believes that industry is behind any contrary view. He sighed. In any case, I promise you there will soon be more computer models showing that extreme weather is increasing. The scientists will get behind this and deliver what is needed.
You know that.
Drake paced. He looked unhappy.
But it just doesn't make sense, he said. It's not logical to say that freezing weather is caused by global warming.
What's logic got to do with it? Henley said. All we need is for the media to report it.
After all, most Americans believe that crime in their country is increasing, when it has actually been declining for 12 years. The U.S. murder rate is as low as it was in the early 1970s. But Americans are more frightened than ever. Because so much more airtime is devoted to crime, they naturally assume there is more in real life, too.
Henley sat up in his chair.
Think about what I am saying to you, Nicholas. A 12-year trend, and they still don't believe it. There is no greater proof that all reality is media reality.
The Europeans are more sophisticated.
Trust me. It'll be even easier to sell abrupt climate change in Europe than in the U.S. You just do it out of Brussels. Because bureaucrats get it, Nicholas. They see the advantages of this shift in emphasis.
Drake did not reply. He walked back and forth, hands in his pockets, staring at the floor.
Just think how far we have come, Henley said. Back in the 1970s, all the climate scientists believed an ice age was coming. They thought the world was getting colder. But once the notion of global warming was raised, they immediately recognized the advantages. Global warming creates a crisis, a call to action. A crisis needs to be studied. It needs to be funded. It needs political and bureaucratic structures around the world. And in no time at all, a huge number of meteorologists, geologists, oceanographers suddenly become climate scientists engaged in the management of this crisis. This will be the same, Nicholas.
Abrupt climate change has been discussed before, and it hasn't caught on.
That's why you are holding a conference, Henley said patiently. You hold a well-publicized conference, and it happens to coincide with some dramatic evidence for the dangers of abrupt climate. And by the end of the conference, you will have established abrupt climate change as a genuine problem.
I don't know.
Stop whining. Don't you remember how long it took to establish the global threat of nuclear winter, Nicholas? It took 5 days. On one Saturday in 1983, nobody in the world had ever heard of nuclear winter. Then a big media conference was held, and by the following Wednesday, the entire world was worried about nuclear winter. It was established as a bona fide threat to the planet, without a single published scientific paper. Drake gave a long sigh.
5 days, Nicholas, Henley said. They did it. You'll do it. Your conference is going to change the ground rules for climate.
The screen went black.
My God, Sarah said.
Evans said nothing. He just stared at the screen. Sanyong had stopped listening some minutes before. He was working with his laptop. Kenner turned to Evans.
When was that segment recorded?
I don't know.
Evans slowly came out of his fog. He looked around the room in a daze.
I have no idea when it was recorded. Why?
You've got the remote in your hand, Kenner said.
Oh, sorry.
Evans pressed the buttons, brought the menu up, saw the date.
It was 2 weeks ago.
So Morton's been bugging Drake's offices for 2 weeks,
Kenner said.
Looks like it.
Evans watched as the recording ran again, this time with the sound off. He stared at the two men, Drake pacing and worried, Henley just sitting there sure of himself. Evans was struggling to assimilate what he had heard. The first recording had seemed reasonable enough to him. There, Drake was complaining about the problems of publicizing a genuine environmental threat, global warming, when everybody naturally ceased to care about the topic in the middle of a snowstorm. All that made sense to Evans. But this conversation... He shook his head. This one worried him.
Sanyong clapped his hands together and said, I've got it! I have the location!
He turned his laptop so everyone could see the screen.
This is Nexrad radar from Flagstaff Pulliam. You can see the precipitation center forming northeast of Payson. There should be a storm there by midday tomorrow.
How far is that from us? Sarah said.
About 90 miles.
Kenner said,
I think we better get in the helicopter.
And do what? Evans said. It's 10 o'clock at night, for God's sake.
Dress warmly, Kenner said.
The world was green and black, the trees slightly fuzzy through the lenses. The night vision goggles pressed heavily against his forehead. There was something wrong with the straps. They cut into his ears and were painful. But everybody was wearing them, looking out the windows of the helicopter at the miles of forest below. They were looking for clearings, and had already passed a dozen or more. Some were inhabited, the houses dark rectangles with glowing windows. In a couple of clearings, the buildings were completely black, ghost towns, abandoned mining communities. But they hadn't yet found what they were looking for.
There's one, Sanyong said, pointing.
Evans looked off to his left. He saw a large clearing. The familiar spiderweb pattern of launchers and cables was partially obscured in tall grass. To one side stood a large trailer truck of the size used to deliver groceries to supermarkets, and indeed, in black lettering, he saw A&P printed on the side panels.
Food terrorists, Sarah said,
but no one laughed. And then the clearing had flashed past. The helicopter continued onward. The pilot had explicit instructions not to slow down or to circle any clearing.
That was definitely one, Evans said. Where are we now?
Tano Forest, west of Prescott, the pilot said. I've marked the coordinates.
Sanyong said, we should find two more, in a 5-mile triangle.
The helicopter thumped onward into the night. It was another hour before they located the remaining spiderwebs, and the helicopter headed home. McKinley Park, Monday, October 11th, 10 a.m. The morning was warm and sunny, although dark clouds threatened to the north. At McKinley State Park, the Lincoln Middle School was having its annual outing. There were balloons attached to the picnic tables, the barbecue grills were smoking, and about 300 kids and their families were playing on the grassy field beside the waterfall, throwing frisbees and baseballs. More were playing along the banks of the nearby Cavender River, which meandered peacefully through the park. The river was low at the moment, with sandy banks on either side, and small rocky pools where the younger children played. Kenner and the others were parked to one side, watching.
"When that river overflows," Kenner said, "it'll take out the entire park and everyone in it."
"It's a pretty big park," Evans said. "Will it really overflow that much?"
"Doesn't take much. The water will be muddy and fast-moving. 6 inches of fast water is enough to knock a person off his feet. Then they slide. It's slippery. They won't be able to get back up again. There are rocks and debris in the water. Mud blinds them. They hit things, lose consciousness. Most drownings occur because people try to move across very low water."
"But 6 inches?"
"Muddy water has power," Kenner said. 6 inches of mud will take a car, no problem. Lose traction, sweep it right off the road. Happens all the time."
Evans found this hard to believe. But Kenner was now talking about some famous flood in Colorado, the Big Thompson, where 140 people died in a matter of minutes.
"Cars crushed like beer cans," he said. "People with clothes ripped off their bodies by mud. Don't kid yourself."
"But here," Evans said, pointing to the park, "if the water starts to rise, there will be enough time to get out."
"Not if it's a flash flood. Nobody here will know until it's too late. That's why we're going to make sure they don't have a flash flood."
He checked his watch, looked up at the darkening sky, and then walked back to the cars. They had 3 SUVs in a row. Kenner would drive one, Sanyong would drive one, Peter and Sarah would drive the 3rd. Kenner opened the back door to his car. He said to Peter,
"Do you have a gun?"
"No."
"You want one?"
"You think I need one?"
"You might. When was the last time you were on a range?"
It's been a while." In truth, Evans had never fired a gun in his life. And until this moment, he was proud of it. He shook his head. "I'm not much of a gun guy." Kenner had a revolver in his hands. He had opened the round barrel thing and was checking it. Sanyong was over by his own car checking an evil-looking rifle, matte black stock with a telescopic sight. His manner was quick, practiced, a soldier. Uneasily, Evans thought, "What is this, the OK Corral?" "We'll be all right," Sarah said to Kenner. "I have a gun."
"You know how to use it?"
"I do."
"What is it?"
"A 9mm Beretta."
Kenner shook his head. "Can you handle a 38?
"Sure." He gave her a gun and a holster. She clipped the holster to the waistband of her jeans. She seemed to know what she was doing. Evans said, "Do you really expect us to shoot somebody?"
"Not unless you have to," Kenner said. "But you may need to defend yourself."
"You think they'll have guns?"
"They might, yes." "Jesus."
"It's okay," Sarah said. "Personally, I'll be happy to shoot the bastards." Her voice was hard, angry.
"All right, then," Kenner said. "That about does it. Let's mount up."
Evans thought, "Mount up? Jesus. This was the OK Corral." Kenner drove to the other side of the park and spoke briefly to a state trooper, whose black and white patrol car stood at the edge of a clearing. Kenner had arranged radio contact with the trooper. In fact, they were all going to be in radio contact, because the plan required a high degree of coordination. They would have to hit the 3 spiderweb sites at the same time. As Kenner explained it, the rockets were intended to do something called charge amplification of the storm. It was an idea from the last 10 years, when people first began to study lightning in the field, in actual storms. The old idea was that each lightning strike decreased the storm's intensity because it reduced the difference in electrical charge between the clouds and the ground. But some researchers had concluded that lightning strikes had the opposite effect. they increased the power of storms dramatically. The mechanism for this was not known, but it was presumed to be related to the sudden heat of the lightning bolt, or the shock wave it created, adding turbulence to the already turbulent storm center. In any case, there was now a theory that if you make more lightning, the storm would get worse.
And the spider webs? Evans said. They're little rockets with microfilaments attached. They go up 1,000 feet into the cloud layer, where the wire provides a low-resistance conduction pathway and creates a lightning strike.
So the rockets cause more lightning. That's what they're for.
Yes, that's the idea.
Evans remained doubtful.
Who pays for all this research, he said. The insurance companies?
Kenner shook his head.
It's all classified, he said.
You mean it's military?
Correct.
The military pays for weather research.
Think about it, Kenner said.
Evans was not inclined to do so. He was deeply skeptical of all things military. The notion that they were paying for weather research struck him as the same sort of ludicrous excess as the $600 toilet seats and $1,000 wrenches that had become so notorious. If you ask me, it's all a waste of money.
Alf doesn't think so, Kenner said.
It was then that Sanyong spoke, with considerable intensity. Evans had forgotten that he was a soldier. Sanyong said that whoever could control the weather would control the battlefield. It was an age-old military dream. Of course the military would spend money on it.
You're saying it actually works?
Yes, Sanyong said. Why do you think we are here?
The SUV wound up into the wooded hills north of McKinley Park. This was an area of intermittent dense forest and open grassy fields. In the passenger seat, Sarah looked at Peter. He was good-looking, and he had the strong physique of an athlete. But sometimes he behaved like such a wimp.
Do you ever do any sports? She asked.
Sure.
What? Squash? A little soccer?
Oh.
Hey, he said, just because I don't shoot guns. I'm a lawyer, for Christ's sake.
She was disappointed with him and not even sure why. Probably, she thought, because she was nervous and wanted somebody competent to be with her. She liked being around Kenner. He was so knowledgeable, so skilled. He knew what was going on. He was quick to respond to any situation, whereas Peter was a nice guy, but... She watched his hands on the wheel. He drove well, and that was important today. It was no longer sunny. They were close to the storm clouds. The day was dark, gloomy, threatening. The road ahead was deserted as it wound through the forests. They hadn't seen a car since they left the park.
How much farther? Evans said.
Sarah consulted the GPS.
Looks like another 5 miles.
He nodded. Sarah shifted in her seat, moving so the holstered gun would not press against her hip. She glanced at the passenger side mirror.
Oh, shit! What?
Behind them was a battered blue pickup truck with Arizona plates.
Auroraville, Monday, October 11th, 10:22 a.m.
We've got trouble, Sarah said.
Why?
Evans said.
He glanced in the rearview mirror, saw the truck.
What is it?
Sarah had the radio in her hand.
Kenner, they spotted us.
Who did?
Evans said.
Who are they?
The radio clicked.
Where are you? Kenner said.
On Highway 95. We're about 4 miles away.
Okay, Kenner said. Stick with the plan. Do your best.
Who is it?
Evans said, looking in the mirror. The blue pickup was advancing fast, very fast. In the next instant, it banged into the back of their car. Evans was startled, swerved, got control again.
What the fuck?
He said.
Just drive, Peter.
Sarah took the revolver from its holster. She held the gun on her lap, looked out the side mirror. The blue truck had dropped back for a moment, but now raced forward again. "Here he comes!" Perhaps because Peter stepped on the gas, the impact was surprisingly gentle. It was hardly more than a nudge. Peter careened around the curves, glancing at the rear-view mirror. Again, the blue truck dropped back. It followed them for the next half mile, but it was never closer than 5 or 6 car lengths.
"I don't get it," Evans said. "Are they going to ram us or not?"
"Guess not," she said. "See what happens if you slow down." He slowed the SUV, dropping their speed to 40. The blue truck slowed too, falling back farther. "They're just following us," she said.
"Why?"
The first scattered drops of rain spattered the windshield. The road ahead was spotted, but they weren't yet in full rain. The blue truck dropped even farther back now. They came around a curve, and immediately ahead of them saw a big silver 18-wheeler with a big trailer. It was rumbling slowly along the road, not going more than 30 miles an hour. On its back doors, it said A&P. "Oh, shit," Evans said. In the back mirror, they saw the blue truck, still following. "They've got us front and back." He swerved out, trying to pass the big trailer, but as soon as he did, the driver moved toward the center of the road. Evans immediately fell back.
"We're trapped," he said.
"I don't know," she said.
"I don't get it."
The trailer blocked them at the front, but behind them the blue truck was farther back than ever, several hundred yards down the road. She was still puzzling over this situation when a bolt of lightning crashed down at the side of the road as they drove past. It couldn't have been more than 10 yards away. A white-hot, dazzling blast of light and sound. They both jumped.
"Jesus, that was close," Evans said.
"Yes.
I've never seen one that close."
Before she could answer, a second bolt crashed down, directly in front of them. The sound was explosive. Evans swerved involuntarily, even though the bolt was gone.
"Holy shit!"
By then, Sarah had a suspicion. Just as the third bolt hit the car itself, a deafening crash and a sudden pressure that made knife pains in her ears and a blast of white that enveloped the car. Evans screamed in fear and let go of the wheel. Sarah grabbed it and straightened the car in the road. A fourth bolt smashed down by the driver's side, just inches from the car. The driver's side window cracked and splintered.
"Holy shit!" Evans was saying. "Holy shit! What is this?"
To Sarah, it was only too obvious. They were attracting lightning. The next bolt cracked down, and it was immediately followed by another, which smashed into the hood and spread burning white jagged fingers over the car, and then was gone. There was a huge black indentation in the hood.
"I can't do this," Evans was saying. I can't do this!
"Drive, Peter," Sarah said, grabbing his arm and squeezing hard. "Drive!" 2 more bolts hit them in rapid succession. Sarah smelled the odor of something burning. She wasn't sure what, but now she understood why they had been so gently rammed. The blue pickup had stuck something onto their car, some kind of electronic thing, and it was drawing the lightning to them.
"What do we do? What do we do?"
Evans was whimpering. He howled as each new bolt struck. But they were trapped, driving on a narrow road, hemmed in by a dense pine forest on both sides of the road. Something she should know.
Forest. What about the forest?
A lightning bolt cracked the rear window with explosive force. Another bolt struck them so hard it bounced the car on the macadam, as if it had been hit by a hammer.
"The hell with this,"
Evans said, and spun the wheel, turning off the highway and onto a dirt track in the forest. Sarah saw a sign flash by, the name of a town on a battered post. They were plunged into near darkness under the huge green pines, but the lightning immediately stopped.
"Of course," she thought. "The trees!"
Even if their car was attracting lightning, it would strike the taller trees first. A moment later it did. They heard a sharp crack just behind them, and lightning flashed down the side of a tall pine, splitting the trunk open with what looked like steam and bursting the tree into flames. "We're going to start a forest fire."
"I don't care," Evans said.
He was driving fast. The vehicle was bouncing over the dirt road, but it was an SUV and it rode high, so Sarah knew they would be all right. Looking back, she saw the tree burning and the fire spreading laterally in fingers along the ground.
Kenner on the radio. "Sarah, what's happening?"
"We had to leave the road. We're being struck by lightning. A lot," Evans yelled. "All the time."
"Find the attractor," Kenner said.
"I think it's attached to the car," Sarah said.
As she spoke, a bolt smashed down on the road just ahead of them. The glare was so bright she saw green streaks before her eyes.
"Then dump the car," Kenner said. "Get out as low as you can."
He clicked off. Evans continued to race forward, the SUV bouncing on the ruts.
"I don't want to leave," he said. "I think we're safer inside. They always say don't leave your car because you're safer inside. The rubber tires insulate you."
"But something's on fire," she said, sniffing. The car jolted and bounced. Sarah tried to keep her balance, just holding onto her seat, not touching the metal of the doors.
"I don't care. I think we should stay,"
Evans said.
"The gas tank might explode."
"I don't want to leave," he said. "I'm not leaving."
His knuckles were white, gripping the wheel. Ahead, Sarah saw a clearing in the forest. It was a large clearing, with high yellow grass. A lightning bolt smashed down with a fearsome crack, shattering the side mirror, which blew apart like a bomb. A moment later, they heard a soft whoomp. The car tilted to one side.
"Oh, shit!" Evan said. "It blew a tire."
"So much for the insulation," she said. The car was now grinding, the underside scraping over a dirt rut, metal squealing.
"Peter," she said. "All right, all right. Just let me get to the clearing. I don't think we can wait."
But the rut ended, the road flattened, and Evans drove forward, creaking on the rim, into the clearing. Raindrops spattered the windshield. Above the grass, Sarah saw the roofs of wooden buildings bleached by the sun. It took her a moment to realize that this was a ghost town, or a mining town. Directly ahead was a sign, Auroraville, Pop 82. Another lightning bolt crashed down, and Evans hit the sign, knocking it over.
"Peter, I think we're here."
"Okay, yeah, let me get a little closer. Now, Peter!"
He stopped the car, and they flung open their doors in unison. Sarah threw herself bodily onto the ground, and another bolt crashed so close to her that the blast of hot air knocked her sideways and sent her rolling on the ground. The roar of the lightning was deafening. She got up on hands and knees and scrambled around to the back of the vehicle. Evans was on the other side of the SUV, yelling something, but she couldn't hear him. She examined the rear bumper. There was no attachment, no device. There was nothing there. But she had no time to think, because another bolt struck the back of the SUV, rocking it, and the rear window shattered, sprinkling her with shards of glass. She fought panic and scrambled forward, staying low as she moved around the SUV and through the grass toward the nearest building. Evans was somewhere ahead, yelling to her, but she couldn't hear him over the rumbling thunder. She just didn't want another bolt, not now, if she could just go a few more seconds. Her hands touched wood, a board, a step. She crawled forward quickly, pushing aside the grass, and now she saw a porch, a dilapidated building, and swinging from the roof, a sign, bleached so gray she couldn't see what it said. Evans was inside. And she scrambled forward, ignoring the splinters in her hands, and he was yelling, yelling. And she finally heard what he was saying. "Look out for the scorpions!" They were all over the wooden porch, tiny, pale yellow, with their stingers in the air. There must have been 2 dozen.
They moved surprisingly fast, scampering sideways like crabs.
Stand up!
She got to her feet and ran, feeling the arachnids crunch under her feet. Another lightning bolt smashed into the building's roof, knocking down the sign, which fell in a cloud of dust onto the porch. But then she was inside the building, and Evans was standing there, fist raised, yelling,
"Yes! Yes! We did it!"
She was gasping for breath. "At least they weren't snakes," she said, chest heaving. Evans said, "What?"
"There are always rattlers in these old buildings."
"Oh, Jesus!" Outside, thunder rumbled, and the lightning started again. Through the shattered, grimy window, Sarah was looking at the SUV and thinking that now they had left the car, there were no more lightning strikes on the SUV, thinking, nothing on the bumper. Then why had the pickup nudged the SUV? What was the point? She turned to ask Evans if he had noticed. And a lightning bolt blasted straight down through the roof, smashing it open to the dark sky, sending boards flying in all directions and blasting into the ground right where she had been standing. The lightning left a blackened pattern of jagged streaks, like the shadow of a thorn bush on the floor. The ozone smell was strong. Wisps of smoke drifted up from the dry floorboards.
"This whole building could go," Evans said.
He was already flinging a side door open, heading outside.
"Stay low,"
Sarah said, and followed him out. The rain was coming down harder, big splattering drops that struck her back and shoulders as she ran to the next building. It had a brick chimney and looked generally better built, but the windows were the same, broken and thickly coated with dust and grime. They tried the nearest door, but it was jammed shut, so they ran around to the front and found that door wide open. Sarah ran inside. A lightning bolt smashed down behind her, sagging the roof over the porch, splintering one of the side posts as it streaked down into the ground. The shockwave blasted the front windows in a shower of dirty glass. Sarah turned away, covering her face, and when she looked out again, she realized she was in a blacksmith shop. There was a large fire pit in the center of the room, and above it all sorts of iron implements hanging from the ceiling. And on the walls, she saw horseshoes, tongs, metal of all sorts. This room was full of metal. The thunder rumbled ominously. "We have to get out of here," Evan shouted. "This is the wrong place to..." He never finished. The next bolt knocked him off his feet as it came crashing down through the ceiling, spinning the iron implements, then smashing into the fire pit, blasting the bricks outward in all directions. Sarah ducked, covering her head and ears, felt bricks striking her shoulders, back, legs, knocking her over. And then there was a burst of pain in her forehead, and she saw brief stars before blackness settled over her. And the rumble of thunder faded to endless silence.
End of CD 8.